This is a People First Radio podcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
More than 550,000 Canadians are caregivers to people living with mental health problems or illnesses. Family caregivers of children and adults with mental illnesses fulfill a distinct and important role by providing support and advocating for their relatives and contributing to their recovery. These caregivers are an invaluable asset to formal health care and social service systems, but the unpredictable nature of many mental illnesses, their longevity, the historical barriers to family involvement within the mental health system, as well as the stigma that is still associated with mental illness, can compromise even the health of family caregivers themselves. In June 2013, the Mental Health Commission of Canada released a set of guidelines for supporting family caregivers of adults with mental health problems and illnesses. And in June 2015, the Commission released a mobilization toolkit. It was designed to help take those guidelines off the shelf and put them into practice. The announcement was made at the Canadian Collaborative Mental Health Care Conference in Calgary. Here's Ed Mantler. He's the Vice President of Programs and Priorities for the Mental Health Commission of Canada.
My name is Ed Mantler. I'm Vice President of Programs with the Mental Health Commission of Canada. It's my pleasure to welcome you here on behalf of the entire commission. A couple of years ago, 2 years ago, at this conference that took place in Montreal, you may recall that the launch of this document took place. It's the National Guideline for a Comprehensive Service System to support family caregivers of adults with mental health problems and illnesses. And I actually had to read it off the document because that title just doesn't roll off my tongue as naturally as it could. So we and I hope you, refer to it simply as the Caregiver Guidelines, which is a little easier to say. As many of you know, the Caregiver Guidelines propose an evidence-based, evidence-informed, comprehensive approach to better meet the needs of family caregiving. The guidelines make 41 distinct recommendations to help system planners, policymakers, mental health managers, people within the system like yourself, to plan, implement, and evaluate a more family-friendly system of care. The recommendations span a number of areas, including better integration of family support across the continuum of health services, improving training and support for health service providers to better understand the role of families and family caregivers, policy changes to recognize the value for health service providers and the role of families, and policy changes to recognize the incredible value of family as caregivers. I'd like to introduce a couple of people. Penny and Ella have joined me, and both were instrumental in the development of the original comprehensive standard. Penny McCourt is a research affiliate at the Center on Aging and an adjunct faculty with Thompson Rivers University School of Social Work. And Penny was the lead researcher on the Caregiver Guidelines. Ella Amir was the project chair of the Commission's former Family Caregivers Advisory Council and as such played an important role in leading the development of the guidelines. And she's executive director of AMI Quebec. Much gratitude is owed to that former Family Caregiver Advisory Council for shepherding the creation of the guidelines. They were developed over the course of 2 years through research, literature review, and consultation with caregivers across the country. Our purpose here today is not only remind you that these exist and have so over the last 2 years, but also to recognize that often very good documents with complicated titles in paper form sit on a shelf and don't get the kind of recognition and the kind of use that they deserve. Our purpose here today to bring these guidelines off the shelf and to mobilize the use of the guidelines. So we'll focus on that today. The message we heard from caregivers when the guidelines were developed was quite clear. Above all else, they need to know that their loved ones are receiving appropriate care and have access to the services and supports that will maximize their potential for a quality of life. Further to that, Caregivers want and need to be meaningfully involved in the assessment and treatment planning, as well as in policy and policy development at all levels. What that tells us is that we have a long way to go in terms of mobilizing the recommendations and implementing the vision of the guideline. Adoption, first and foremost, requires a cultural shift in the role that caregivers can play inside and outside the mental health system, in addition to transforming the system with a goal to making it truly recovery-oriented. And this is where people like you, people within the system, leaders and providers within the mental health system, can make a big difference. Mental health problems and illnesses are one of the leading reasons for a person, a family member, to provide care, and it's the number one reason for a parent to provide care to a child, including an adult child. You know, when I was growing up, I recall that I had an aunt. It was actually my mom's aunt who lived with my grandparents, Auntie Nancy. And since she was there throughout my childhood, as long as I could remember, it seemed like a natural place for her to be. It seemed like the natural order of the world, and in no way seemed like a burden. She had been with my grandmother, in fact, her sister, since they were children together, and they had never separated. And although clearly her behavior was odd at times in the eyes of a child, it seemed in no way not the normal course of action, what should be happening. And while my grandmother never projected it to be a burden, I know in retrospect that it had a huge impact on her social opportunity, never having a day off, very rare occasions to have a vacation, and other impacts on her life. And while I think I and they recognize the huge positive impact that had on the quality of life for Auntie Nancy, I think it had a significant impact on the lives of my grandparents. It also had a very positive impact on me, growing up as a child, seeing that as normalcy and the normal way that families work together and care for one another. I think it helped shape who I am as a person and, you know, make my decisions to pursue a career in mental health. It wasn't until much later, when my grandmother couldn't continue with that and Auntie Nancy came to live with my parents, that I saw that, the world had become a more complicated place, and being older, I could see the difficulties and the complexities. Caregivers today are reporting even higher levels of stress and are often struggling for a balance of work, to balance work and life with their caregiving responsibilities. Caregivers of adults with serious mental illnesses often face additional and unique stressors because of the stigma associated with mental illness, because of historical barriers, and because of the way that the system itself is structured. Taking the guidelines off the shelf, a mobilization toolkit was developed to support individuals, groups, and organizations in their efforts to help others understand and implement the recommendations of the caregiver guidelines. It's intended for anyone who wants to see the guidelines put into practice, helping to move recommendations from words on a page to concrete actions. The toolkit provides resources and guidance to people to plan and execute education and advocacy efforts with decision makers who have the authority to make change.
That was Ed Mantler. He's the Vice President of Programs and Priorities for the Mental Health Commission of Canada. Mantler was announcing the release of a mobilization toolkit designed to support caregivers and organizations in order to help them understand and implement recommendations that are outlined in the National Guidelines for a Comprehensive Service System to Support Family Caregivers of Adults with Mental Health Problems and Illnesses. That set of guidelines was first released in June 2013 by the Commission. Ed Mantler was joined by Penny McCourt, a consultant and researcher from Nanaimo, British Columbia, and Ella Amir, executive director of the Montreal-based organization Action on Mental Illness. Both Penny McCourt and Ella Amir were involved in the development of the caregiver guidelines.
Penny and Ella have joined us, and we're so fortunate to have their wisdom and experience at the table and in the room today. I wonder if you could share a bit more about your experience. Ella Amir was the project chair of the Commission's former Family Caregivers Advisory Council, and as such played an important role in leading the development of the guidelines, and she's executive director of AMI Quebec. Based on the experience that you've had, why do you think it's so important that change for caregivers take place, and why do you think it is that now is the right time to really push for that change?
In relation to your question about why the time is right now, I don't think that it's necessarily now. I think that it should have been a long time ago. But I think that we are starting to recognize that caregivers should be brought under the tent. And I think that it's most appropriate that we launched 2 years ago the guidelines for caregiver support at this collaborative care conference, and we are launching the toolkit in the same conference. I think that it's different kind maybe of shared care, a different kind of collaborative care, but I think that it's in the last workshop that I attended, we were talking about bringing First Nations together with Western culture under one tent. I think that this is exactly the same with caregivers. I think that it's about time. I think that the Mental Health Commission of Canada had done a great deal to advance the and recognize and advance the importance of caring for caregivers. And I think that there are really two good reasons why we should absolutely do that. The first one, because it's very costly. Not to do that is likely to be much more costly than actually to provide information, guidance, and support to caregivers. And we know from different studies that the cost to the economy, to the Canadian economy, is enormous, about $50 billion a year in today's dollars. And this is not factoring in the cost that is associated with caregivers' related issues, such as problems in the workforce and so on and so forth. So the first reason is because it's costly, and I think that this is probably the language that funders are going to recognize. So this is why it's so important. The other reason is because it is right to do so. You know, it may sound like an election speech, but it's not. I think that it's just right, you know, for a civil society, I think that this is our responsibility to look after people who are challenged by different kind of issues and provide them the information, the guidance and support that they require. And I would argue that if we do that, we are probably going to prevent caregivers from becoming collateral casualties of mental illness. And if we are going to do that, caregivers are likely to be able to offer better support to their loved ones. If we are not going to do that, caregivers are probably going to experience negative consequences of their caregiving, and again, it's going to be very costly to the system. And the third reason is, as I said, I think that the contribution of unpaid informal caregivers cannot be underestimated. So these are really two good reasons to do that yesterday, but if not yesterday, today.
Penny McCourt is a research affiliate at the Center on Aging and an adjunct faculty with Thompson Rivers University School of Social Work. And Penny was the lead researcher on the caregiver guidelines. Can you care to add to that?
Well, that was very fulsome, so let's see what I can add to it. I think one of the other reasons, well, I guess firstly, I think, as Ella said it, you know, it should have happened before now. In other parts of the healthcare system, particularly with older adults, caregivers have been on the radar for quite a long time. The issue around the economic argument is very strong for supporting caregivers, and also for the idea of not having them as collateral damage and keeping them able to do what they do for as long as possible. Of course, the flip side of that is that caregivers can be seen as an opportunity by funders to provide care to, and are seen as an opportunity by funders to provide care at no cost. We keep talking about $50 billion. It's not like we're going to put $50 billion in and give it to them. It's the idea that they need support themselves if it's not going to be a question of everybody getting on the bandwagon in order to utilize them without the necessary supports. I think the aging population is another reason why the time is definitely now. A lot of the caregivers, as you said, are older adults or adults looking after adult children and their aging. And the big issue is what do you do in the future? And I think that's the two main things that I would like to say about that.
That's great. Thank you very much. So not only a business driver, a huge economic driver to make this make sense, but also it's simply the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. I like that. There are 41 recommendations within the document, and someone looking at it for the first time, Penny, might say, well, where do we begin? How do we even start if we're just learning about the recommendations and the value of family caregiving? So if you could give advice on what are a couple of key things that might jump out at you as the most important things to start addressing right away, what might that be?
Wow, is that ever a hard question? Because all those, they're all really important, and a lot of it depends on the context in which you work. Like an overarching one is to get caregivers involved in developing and evaluating all the programs that affect them or affect the person they're caring for. That's a big overarching policy thing for government, mental health system, and so forth. But I think the other piece is making room for caregivers and making it actually required that caregivers are involved in the treatment and discharge planning of their family members insofar as they're able to be and is appropriate. One of the big things we heard was how closed out families feel by the healthcare system, pushed out. Like one woman said, the assumption is that we don't want to help, or the assumption is that we're bad. You know, that's old history, right? The other thing is assessing caregivers who are diverse in terms of their relationships, ethnicity, in terms of their financial means, their coping strategies, their other responsibilities, all those kinds of things, personality factors, everything, you know, that makes them diverse needs to be assessed, to be understood, and they need to be assessed at every contact we have in terms of their learning needs, their understanding of the illness, of the illness trajectory, and also what they can do, what can be helpful for them, and also things around their personal needs too, because aside from them just being people who look after someone with mental illness, there are also a whole lot of other things to their employees, their mothers, their fathers. There are many other roles that they have to play, and they also have individual needs for social opportunities, employment, and so forth.
Thank you. Ella Amir, did you care to add to that?
It's a very difficult question because I don't think that there is one recommendation which is more important than another. I think that it's really circumstantial. I think that it really depends on the context. I think that it depends on, as you have seen or you will be seeing, the guidelines are, the recommendations are grouped into several categories to help you navigate the system. I think that it really depends on the people who are going to drive these guidelines, recommendations, and it depends on the people who are going to receive this information and to consider the implementation. Ed mentioned that these guidelines were developed specifically for service providers, decision makers, policy makers, and so on and so forth. But I believe that the driver of this implementation are not necessarily going to be these people. The drivers, in all likelihood, are going to be family members, family associations, and interested people who are not necessarily so intensely involved in actual delivery of services. So I think that it really depends who you are going to work with and where these recommendations are likely to be implemented. Some of the recommendations are relatively easy to implement and probably are just an improvement or promotion or extension of already existing policies in different places. Some other recommendations are more complex, may require more funding, and maybe changes in policies. I can just give one complex recommendation, but I think that it happened to be one of the very important ones, is to have a peer support worker. We are quite familiar now with peer support workers in the context of mental health, but when we talk about people with mental health problems. But we are talking now about a caregiver, peer support caregiver worker, who would be placed in the emergency department or somewhere in the hospital where psychiatric patients are arriving with their caregivers. Caregivers, I should say also, very often tend to minimize their needs. And I think that it's really, the onus is on us, on care, on service providers, is to offer the help in spite of their very often reluctance to accept this help. So, you know, having a peer support worker in the emergency department, for example, that will be meeting a caregiver in crisis is invaluable.
Ella Amir is executive director of the Montreal-based organization Action on Mental Illness. Penny McCourt is a consultant and researcher from Nanaimo, British Columbia. And Ed Mantler is Vice President of Programs and Priorities for the Mental Health Commission of Canada. You can find the caregiver guidelines and the mobilization toolkit, along with much more information, online at mentalhealthcommission.ca. You can find out more about the Canadian Collaborative Mental Health Care Conference online at shared-care.ca. We're sharing presentations on our broadcast today about mobilizing support for family caregivers of people with mental health problems and illnesses. Stay with us for more.
This is People First Radio across the islands on CHLY 101.7 FM and streaming online at chly.ca. Find out more. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpages.
More than 550,000 Canadians are caregivers to people living with mental health problems or illnesses. Family caregivers of children and adults with mental illnesses fulfill a distinct and important role by providing support and advocating for their relatives and contributing to their recovery. These caregivers are an invaluable asset to formal health care and social service systems, but the unpredictable nature of many mental illnesses, their longevity, the historical barriers to family involvement within the mental health system, as well as the stigma that is still associated with mental illness, can compromise the health of family caregivers themselves. In June 2013, the Mental Health Commission of Canada released a set of guidelines for supporting family caregivers of adults with mental health problems and illnesses. And in June 2015, the Commission released a mobilization toolkit. It was designed to help take those guidelines off the shelf and put them into practice. The announcement was made at the Canadian Collaborative Mental Health Care Conference in Calgary, and it was followed by a workshop focused on how to use that mobilization toolkit. Here's Benita Varga, a knowledge broker with the Mental Health Commission of Canada, and Ella Amir, Executive Director of the Montreal-based organization Action on Mental Illness.
Ella Amir is the Executive Director of ME Quebec, which is a caregiving organization. She's also a member of the MHCC's Advisory Council. So she's going to talk to you a little bit about the guidelines and give us an overview.
Well, you know, basically what you see here are just two clauses in this strategy, in the mental health strategy that the Mental Health Commission of Canada developed that refer to family caregivers. Again, you know, I mentioned earlier, and I'll just repeat it, that I think that the Commission had done a remarkable job in helping to recognize caregivers. I have to say, however, that it wasn't necessarily an easy task for the Family Caregivers Advisory Committee, even though I think that the Commission had the wisdom to have Family Caregivers Advisory Committee as one of the eight advisory committees. It has been challenging because I think that even people in the mental health field still don't recognize the importance of family caregivers. But I think that caught up with the Family Caregivers Advisory Committee and the guidelines that were launched 2 years ago, and first of all, you know, the reference in the strategy to the importance of caregivers and the guidelines were really the highlights of this recognition. So, again, I'm not going to tire you with too many details, but I think that if you are here, it is likely that you have an interest in caregivers, and either professionally or you know someone or personally and so on and so forth. We do know that there are about 8 million caregivers in Canada. This is a report of Stats Canada from 2013, which refers to 2012, I believe. And we know also there were further reports that talked about 35% of the workforce are also fulfilling caregiving responsibilities. This counts to 6.1 million caregivers. So what we are seeing here that about 75% of caregivers are also working, and this is a huge burden. As you see here, more than half a million Canadians report that they provide care to loved one with mental health problems or illness. And mental health problems count as viewed as the first reason for parents who provide care to children and adult children and also spouses. It's interesting to note that in Stats Canada report, there are other caregivers in different domains that are probably more numerous than the caregivers in the context of mental health. For example, caregivers to the elderly are quite many more than caregivers in the context of mental health. However, the caregivers to people with mental illness and mental health problems carry a heavier burden. And I'm not talking only from the duration of the caregiving support. As we know, caregivers to elderly, the time is very often limited. When you're talking about someone with schizophrenia or bipolar or other mental illnesses, very often is a lifelong caregiving responsibilities. So the burdens that caregivers in this context share are higher than the burden of caregivers in other domains. And I think that this is really very important. Nearly 50% of parents providing care to their children and 38% caring for a spouse say that they spent $2,000 or more during the last 12 months period. And again, we don't have the details here about the challenges that they are faced in the workplace, but we know that they very often have a difficulty to juggle their caregiving responsibilities with their work expectations, because very often they work in a not necessarily caregiver-friendly systems. What do caregivers need? So I think that it's probably implied in what I said about what caregivers are going through, and Ed also mentioned that. Caregivers, in their own words, what they say is that they want to know, first of all, that the relative is being attended to, that the relatives are being cared for, that the care is appropriate, that he can access the services that he requires. They want also to know that their relationship and their contribution is recognized and valued by service providers. They want also to be engaged to the extent that it's possible in treatment planning, in policy development, and so on and so forth. And, of course, they want to have access to information and support from service providers in a timely manner so they will be able to offer their supports to their loved ones in a timely fashion. And lastly, is have their personal needs outside of the caregiving role recognized. And, again, I I find it important to repeat it again, because I think that it's really very often typical and common to many caregivers. When they come to the hospital, they don't see themselves as the recipient of support or of help. Very often when they come with a loved one with serious mental illness, they feel that, how can I ask for help for myself when I'm looking for someone who has such a serious mental illness? But as I said earlier, I think that it really behooves on us to offer this support, to provide this support, because very often family caregivers don't recognize the price that they are likely to pay long-term if they are not properly supported. So this brings us to the caregivers' guidelines. And as, again, we said, the Family Caregivers Advisory Committee existed with the Mental Health Commission for the first 5 years of its operation, like all the other advisory committees. And this is really the culmination of the work of the committee. The recommendations, and again Ed alluded to it, are meant to guide a policy planners and decision makers in implementing a caregiver-friendly system that would allow caregivers to fulfill their caregiving responsibilities in a responsible way, without compromising or with reducing the anxiety or the compromise of their health as they do the caregiving role. And the last thing that I would say is, again, I said it earlier, that I think that it's really important to recognize who is likely to guide this process. But I think that if family associations or people who are interested are not going to have partners in the healthcare system or in the other systems where recommendations can be implemented, it's just not going to be taken off the shelves. So again, it takes the collaboration of many stakeholders to make sure that these guidelines do not remain just an impressive academic document, but it's really becoming a tool that will change the trajectory of caregivers to the better.
That was Ella Amir, Executive Director of the Montreal-based organization Action on Mental Illness. In June 2013, the Mental Health Commission of Canada released a set of guidelines designed to support family caregivers of adults with mental health problems and illnesses. And in June 2015, the Commission released a mobilization toolkit. It's intended to help take those guidelines off the shelf and put them into practice. The announcement was made at the Canadian Collaborative Mental Health Care Conference in Calgary, and it was followed by a workshop that focused on how to use that mobilization toolkit. Benita Varga, a knowledge broker with the Mental Health Commission of Canada, led that workshop designed to help participants use the toolkit. Benita Varga picks up from Ella Amir's presentation.
So as Ella mentioned, there are 41 recommendations in the document for five sectors. So we really broke it down pretty plainly into integrating family support into mental health services. And as you'll see in the documents, it's actually broken down into three. So acute care, general care, and community services. And then we've got training and support for mental health service providers. We look at the government and policy level, intersectoral partnerships, and public awareness. So now I actually want to talk about the toolkit. And I'm going to keep this pretty short because I actually think it's more interesting for us to get to use it than just to look at it. So are any of you working on knowledge mobilization or knowledge translation? Any hands? A couple of hands? Great. So at the Commission, we sort of talk about knowledge mobilization. It's really about using what we know works. And what we know works comes in the form of research, evidence, but also experience. And we use that to help transform the mental health system. For us, knowledge is data. It's data and it's information, and it's contextualized through our own experiences. I could give you a data point and I could put it up there, and it wouldn't mean anything to you without context, without a sort of discussion around it. So for us, knowledge is also really a social activity. It becomes knowledge once it becomes real to us and we start to engage with it. Mobilization, it's really the process of putting it into active use. I guess the other thing I just want to mention is that at the Commission we sort of talk about knowledge as four types of knowledge, which is experiential, scientific, pragmatic, and cultural. So there are lots of different ways of knowing things, and so I don't want to say that it's only research or it's only evidence. There's lots of ways to know things and to know that things work. I have a little quiz for you. Do you know, on average, how long do you think it takes to move research or knowledge into practice? 3 years, 8 years, 12 years, or 17 years? 12, I hear 17. Any other takers? The answer? 17 years. So it's taking us a long time to move the things that we know work and we know are important into actual practice. So part of why this toolkit is so important is that we want it to live. We want it to be used, and we want people to put it into practice, make it work. So why did we choose to make a toolkit? A couple of reasons. First, the guidelines actually got rave reviews from caregivers, from caregiver advocates, from caregiver organizations. They really resonated with people. Our team, who are sitting here, did a phenomenal job on the research, on the engagement, on really listening and hearing to what caregivers needed and how we could, I guess, reorient the system to be really family-friendly. Part of what the former Family Caregiver Advisory Committee did is that many of them took these guidelines back into their communities. People like Ella, people like Penny have done some really great work with it. And a lot of caregivers came back to the commission saying, we want to know what people are doing with this. We love them. We've tried this, but we want to know what else is working. So part of what this toolkit does is it provides case studies and examples of how people are using it, what they've done, how it's worked. And then finally, the guidelines are pretty broad. We looked at this in a really sort of holistic way, but communities often know best what they need, and caregivers who are the ones accessing services and helping their loved ones navigate often know what their communities really need. So they may look at these guidelines and think, 41 recommendations, I can't do them all, but I know that if we could get these two recommendations mobilized in our community, it's going to make a huge difference. So rather than throwing the book at people and saying you've got to do them all, we're hoping that we can help people really zoom in and say, this is what I need to do in my community. So what is it? Like Ed mentioned, the toolkit is a support for individuals, groups, or organizations in their efforts to help others understand and implement the guidelines. It's available online. It's fully interactive. The nice thing about it is you can go online and you can use the resources. You can type it in there. You can delete. You can whatever. And then you can print it out and it's there. If you're a paper person, you can print it out. You can work in the activities that way. How was it developed? We worked with members of our former advisory committee to come up with some of these ideas. We piloted it with caregivers across Canada, got their responses, incorporated that feedback into the document. And as Ella mentioned, who it's for? Ideally, it's for caregivers, caregiver advocates, caregiver organizations, the people from the bottom up that are really trying to mobilize this. But at the same time, for you, if you're a lot of care, I guess if you're working within the system here, there are tools in here that you could use to take to your boards, to your directors. There's lots in there that I think is very usable. So what do you find in the document? You find the background on the issue, which is 30 pages, fairly plain language stuff on updated information, a planning guide, case studies, and other supporting resources. Then we've got a planning questionnaire that I'm hoping we're all going to use together. There's planning activities, the facilitator guide, sample letters, sample summary documents, also a briefing note for people who are trying to get stuff going with their board members or with policymakers. There's a bit in there about telling your story, which is a way for caregivers to start to incorporate their messages, their stories, into the work that they're doing in the communities, because often they know why they're doing this. They've had an experience, and that experience is telling them why the system needs to change. So we wanted to help them be able to use that effectively. There's meeting checklists, and there's also PowerPoint slides that people can use and go out and make presentations. Pretty straightforward on getting started. We recommend people start by taking a good long look at the guidelines, getting familiar with the recommendations, going in and then using the background on the issues, finding there's updated stats in there, there's updated information, figuring out how they want to plan their mobilization activities, and then getting into the planning questionnaire, which will help guide how to use the rest of the toolkit.
That was Benita Varga, a knowledge broker with the Mental Health Commission of Canada, leading a workshop focused on a mobilization toolkit designed to help support family caregivers of people with mental health problems and illnesses. The mobilization toolkit, released during the Canadian Collaborative Mental Health Care Conference in June 2015, is meant to help animate an earlier comprehensive set of guidelines and recommendations for supporting caregivers. You can find the caregiver guidelines and the mobilization toolkit, along with much more information, online at mentalhealthcommission.ca. You can find out more about the Canadian Collaborative Mental Health Care Conference online at shared-care.ca.
People First Radio is an initiative of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and broadcast on CHLY 101.7, radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the partnering organizations. Listen to People First Radio on demand. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpages.